Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
All right, look at that.
I'll send you an invoice.
All right. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Shaping and Using Fantasy Languages. I'm Jessica Price. I am the project manager at Paizo. Make the trains run on time.
Thankfully. And I'm John Compton, organized play lead developer.
So, we are here to talk about making languages in your game more than just a stat or a word on a list. You know, there's a tendency to reduce languages in game to something really mechanical, like, this scroll is in Draconic. Who has Draconic? You have Draconic? Okay, then you understand that the scroll says this. Or like, make a linguistics check to decipher this. You rolled an 18, good enough. This is what it says. So we're going to talk about ways to make it a bit more robust and involve players more in your stuff. Alright, so yes, that is the Tower of Babel. I maybe went a little overboard on finding art for this.
No substance.
We are super geeky. We'd be really remiss if we didn't geek out about this. So, hope you're going to geek with us. Okay, there we go. So, first thing we're going to talk about is conlangs, or constructed languages. Like, for example, J.R.R. Tolkien's Sindarin and Quenya, his two Elven languages. Actually, we don't have time to do an entire panel on conlangs. We could do, like, an entire day, or possibly an entire semester. When I was taking linguistics in college, David Salo, the guy who did the languages for the Lord of the Rings movies, was a grad student in my department, and came and gave us a... came and gave a talk on constructed languages and how they differ from natural languages, and it was great, and he got through, like, points 1 and 2 out of, like, 35, and then it was like, well, and we're out of time. So, conlangs are cool, but they're also really complicated. This is not a panel on how to create your own language. However, we are going to do a little conlang-like stuff. This is also the Tower of Babel ahead of me. So we're going to talk about three aspects of language that can help you make language in your game come alive, make things sound like they're part of a consistent culture and language. First one is phonology, the second one is derivational morphology, and the third one is naming conventions. So, and you can jump in anytime you want.
Fantastic.
A lot, because I made the deck, so phonology is the sounds that make up a language. Derivational morphology is how new words get generated in a language, and naming conventions is exactly what it sounds like, how you name things like people.
And with phonology, one of the things that you can do when you're looking at one of your conlangs is basically decide what are some of the sounds that do exist, what are some of the sounds that don't exist. And when we're talking about conlangs, like, you don't have to make a 3,000, 10,000 word constructed language for your Pathfinder game. Nobody's asking you to do that, except maybe us.
You're on my back.
Oh, goodness.
Is it in there?
Yeah. And so
this is way less impressive since it printed it double-sided. I was like, hey, Eric, I think we should publish this reference grammar I made for Kelish when I did Kadira, and like it was twice as thick because it wasn't double-sided, so I like dropped it on the desk. It's really fun. Anyway, it exists. It's fun. Cool.
But you might even decide, okay, Dwarven is going to have a lot of K's and R's and T's and D sounds, and you might decide it's going to have very few Q sounds or what have you. Even having that basic level of idea of what sorts of sounds you have in your alphabet and your pronunciation is going to be really important in determining.
I have a video.
Some basic naming conventions. That way you don't create a name that's going to break your standard.
So, I have a video because I'm a giant dork. So this is a guy named Eric Singer. He is a movie dialect coach that helps actors pronounce, you know, or helps actors do different English dialects, helps actors when they have to learn a fictional language or a natural language. So he's going to explain a bunch of that stuff about Dothraki from Game of Thrones. So
have you tested your volume?
Haven't.
Oh boy.
This will be exciting.
Game of Thrones. Keep it on the shore. Mama, where are you? Where are you?
in that line, which is saying something like, I will give to him a golden crown that men will tremble when they see it. You hear,
Aquarius, Aquarius.
That's that uvular plosive.
Aquarius.
Which means will tremble. It's the future tense of hovat, which is to tremble. Some people think Dothraki sounds like Arabic. Its natural language influences are more from Turkish, Russian, Swahili, and Inuktitut.
Here's Johnny!
American English has a really weird R sound, this thing that you do when you bunch up your tongue.
Alrighty then.
This is a really weird sound. It barely exists in any other language on Earth, and it's a weird thing to do with your tongue, so it's often really hard both for kids to acquire.
Serious.
Takes until about 5.
Serious.
It's hard for non-native speakers, so it gets left out of conlangs because it also just kind of sounds like American English.
Let's get ready to rumble!
One really popular approach is to have a tapped R. Like in an old-fashioned British,
now is the winter of our discontent, glorious summer, then.
Here you can hear it in High Valyrian. Dothraki. Klingon. Interestingly, Valyrian has the same contrast Spanish does. Two different R sounds which can change the meaning of a word. One is a tap,
in perro.
The other is a trill.
Or rolled R in perro.
Different word, only one different sound. Dothraki has sometimes a tap, sometimes a trill. It doesn't actually make a difference in the meaning of the word. Here it's a trill.
I used linguistic evolution as a characterization tool, basically giving insight into the history of the speakers.
So Khal Drogo is a native speaker of Dothraki, and it sure seems like he is, even though it's a made-up language. Daenerys is learning it. And here in the first season, you can kind of hear she's not a native speaker. Later on, though, and this makes sense for the character, right? This isn't the actress getting better at it. It's them telling the story of the character becoming more of a fluent speaker of Dothraki. Listen to it here. The brilliant Jan Hayden Rowles, who's a friend and colleague, is the dialect coach for Game of Thrones.
Yeah, that's me.
So she does all the Dothraki and Valyrian.
That's right.
The actors do a really good job.
Oh, they sure do.
Jason Momoa's Dothraki sounds great, doesn't it? I mean, you completely buy him as a native speaker, and that's a credit to the actor.
Very nice of you.
Who doesn't actually speak any other languages besides English, and I suppose now some Dothraki. Dothraki, though, is much more fully developed in terms of vocabulary.
You throat rip.
False. Agenti.
It's got like 3,000 words, I think.
Is she it, throat rips?
Valyrian has less than 1,000 at this point, but it's growing.
To create an authentic sounding language, one needs to employ an authentic methodology. Thank you.
Conlang 5.
Yeah, so he's great, and you should watch his videos on YouTube. They're amazing. He also critiques the dialect of 36 different actors in different movies. It's great. Point is, all of these languages sound like they do because they have a limited sound set. There are sounds that are in these languages and there are sounds that are not. And so if you are creating elven characters, you want to look at the names of elven places and look at not just what sounds are present, but also how syllables are constructed. So in elven, we generally don't have consonants that are next to each other. They're almost always separated by vowels. So it gives it this very sort of flowing sound. Dwarven names tend to have a lot of consonant clusters, which makes it more sort of guttural, more abrupt and harsh sounding.
And one of the nice things about having this regularity of how you're constructing your language, or at least constructing the sound of the language that you want to go with and the naming conventions, is that it helps to create an idea, not even a cognitive idea, that that there's identity to this. Sort of like you can go to various parts of the world and see certain architectural standards and say, oh, I am here. You can hear one of the classically elven names and you'll say, oh, right, the sound structure sounds right. But if you hear Jimbo Anthelos, then suddenly there's a break in, oh, that first bit is not elven, thank you very much. And it can be dissonant when it doesn't work. So That's one of the ways of creating identity.
It also, when you have a consistent phonology for, if you have an inconsistent phonology, it can rob the culture of any sense of being a culture, right? In that, you know, if any name sounds like it could be Elven, there's no such thing as an Elven sounding name. This is the International Phonetic Alphabet, which, you know, if you're interested in creating either your own culture so you're not basing it on stuff in our setting, and so you want to come up with, like, your own sound for what does this particular culture's names, places sound like. The IPA is sort of an inventory of every type of sound. There are a few exceptions that are not represented there, but in general, every type of sound made in any human language. And so you can go through and kind of, if you go to the Wikipedia page on it, all of the symbols are links, so you can listen to what they sound like. There's a lot of weird symbols. That's because, you know, we have languages that don't use the Roman alphabet, and so, you know, we don't necessarily have a letter that represents that particular sound, which is why if you see, like, transliterations of Arabic or other Semitic languages, you can see the same word transliterated, like, six different ways, because we just don't have the right symbols to represent those sounds. So you can go through and kind of pick out, like, I like that sound, but that sound sounds like a sound that a dwarf would make, or, like, a fish. These are fish people. They don't have lips. You know, what sounds can they make?
And even with this, one of the nice things that it does, if you're not looking at it strictly academically, but you just want to be like, I don't know, what kind of sounds do we have? It even breaks it down by, like, the placement of where the tongue is and how open the mouth is for creation of vowels. And so if you want to have, oh yeah, they tend to speak with their tongue toward the front, you can establish what those sounds are going to be and just be like, all right, let's cut out the other ones. Great.
Yeah, remember, limiting the number of sounds is really important because that is what gives it a coherent sound. I'm using the term sound a lot, but if you have too many phonemes, again, you don't get a sense of the sounds in this particular way. So things to think about are what sounds are present or absent, consonant frequency, so there's a... How often different sounds appear in the language is one of the things that can make it sound different. If you have a language with a lot of, like, L sounds, you know, Welsh has a lot of L sounds, which is why it sounds very pretty, which is why Tolkien used it as one of the bases for Sindarin. Also, what does a syllable look like? Again, that comes back to, is every consonant separated by vowels, or do you have consonants clustered together? This link is a link to a particular tool that you can use that you can order the consonants in the frequency that you want them, and it will just generate words for you. So if you want to come up with just a phrase in a language, like, it's a real easy way to be like, I want it to have lots of these sounds and none of these sounds, and it will just make words for you. So I did some Kalish on the blog when we released Kadira. Kalish, if you're not particularly familiar with our setting, we have a sort of Middle Eastern culture called the Empire of Kalesh. Kalesh is the language that they speak. I was not allowed to put it in the books because the editors have enough to do with editing English. They're like, don't start putting a made-up language in there, and it's like, fine, but I'm going to put it on the blog. So it is semi-canon. So, like, one of the things that Kalesh is based on Semitic languages, to give it that sound that makes people think Middle Eastern. One of the things it doesn't have, for example, is a CH sound, the CH sound. It does have a unvoiced velar fricative, like in Bach or Chutzpah, which is one of the sounds that people who make conlangs love it because we don't really have it in English, and so it makes, you know, your fictional language sound different from English, but it's also really common in natural languages. Consonant frequency, like, has a lot of H's, it has a lot of R's, it has a lot of N's, S and S, H, L. It has less, like, K sounds and stuff like that. So that is one of the things that makes it sound like it. Syllable types, it doesn't separate every syllable with vowels, so, which is one of the characteristics of, like, Arabic and Hebrew. So these are examples. So you can kind of see that some letters occur more than others. Yes, Microsoft Word didn't like it very much. but, you know, I can't help the fact that Microsoft Word is, you know, Uneducated. So derivational morphology is also, if you decide to create like phrases in your language and you want your players to have some sense when a new word comes up of like, oh, that sounds familiar, that sounds like part of a coherent language, I recognize it from this other phrase I learned. Derivational morphology is how new words get formed in English. This usually involves adding a prefix or suffix. So for example, if you have the word happy, you can make happiness or unhappy by putting in prefixes and suffixes.
And some of it's just invention on the fly, and this can be something that's great for your players to play around with, because once you've sort of taught them, like, let's say 10 words in whatever made-up language you've decided to use in your game, and they learn that "edi" is a suffix for a comparative, they might start making their own versions of those words using the little bit of vocabulary that you've come up with, and even adopt them as their own little taglines. So it can be great fun. It gives them ownership of your setting.
So naming conventions. One of the easiest ways to, if you don't want to make up, you know, your own language, if you don't want to make up your own names, one of the easiest ways to give a particular culture or location a sense of being different from another location is to use real life languages to approximate in world languages. So, for example, I know a group where they use Welsh to approximate Sindarin, or to approximate Elven. It's easy. You can obviously translate things by Google Translate.
Like spells in Harry Potter.
Like spells in Harry Potter are basically Latin, right?
Some translations are better than others. Some
translations are better than others. You also need to be careful because, especially if you're like writing for a third party, this is fraught with potential danger because words mean things, and sometimes they mean things that are not obvious if you don't really speak that language.
Tied into that, even if you're borrowing names from a culture that has inspired your fantasy culture, be really cautious about adopting names directly, because that could be really awkward. Like, if you have decided that, oh yeah, we're going to name our orcs using, or orc is going to sound kind of like this language. What are some names from that language? Oh, okay, I'm going to call my orc villain this thing. Oh, surprise, that is some sort of, like, it's an innuendo, or
it's a national hero.
It's a saint.
Yeah.
It's a national hero, or something like that. And suddenly, you have either, I mean, if you've done it for a home game, okay, probably nobody will ever call you on it. If you've done it in publication, it might be something where it's like, what have you done?
We actually had this problem with, we had a freelancer a while back who named all their hobgoblin villains after, like, Turkish national heroes. Turns out there's PFS in Turkey, and they were like, the fuck? We narrowly escaped something pretty bad with one of our bestiaries, in which we had a bug creature that was inspired by, I want to say, maybe species or something like that that I haven't seen. But the one of the bugs in that movie is called the Judas strain, and so somebody went and figured out, like, well, like, what's the original? Where did the name Judas come from? Oh, it's Hebrew. Okay, well, what's the Hebrew version? And so I'm editing it, and I get to the bug person, which is called a Yehuda. And I'm like, literally means Jew in Hebrew.
Oh,
like,
God.
Maybe let's not do that. Okay. So we caught it before we published it. But, like, yeah, really potentially bad, you know, so.
But if you're going into a game and you're using real-world languages or Google Translate or something like that as sort of an accepted tool in expressing language, or like hiding the meaning of language, like behind a spoiler tag sort of thing, it can work out amazingly well. I've played in a number of play-by-post campaigns online, and one of the more interesting and innovative ones for me is one where it was a campaign setting where we decided there was no common language, which was an absolute pain in a way for our group to even begin to communicate with each other, because I think like only three of us spoke each other's language. But what we did is we came up with, for the 20 languages or so in the system, we just assigned a real-world language to each one, and we decided every time that we were going to say something in that language, we would take it, we'd plug it into Google Translate and say, make this Turkish! And then we would just slap it onto the speech bubble and put a spoiler of what it was intending to say. And even if the translation wasn't perfect or what have you, it was still enough to show, oh, hey, here's some common words that are showing up again and again. Here's the length of what I was trying to say. And, oh, hey, here's a general soundscape or set of sounds that we can associate with this language because we need something as a good placeholder. So that can create a great smokescreen for play-by-play post games.
And it's also, you don't have to share every piece of information with the entire table, right? If you have one character in a party that speaks the language, you can, if you're jamming, you can text the player the translation and let them decide when to share, let them decide if they share.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Pass a note. Yeah, or pass a note.
One of the common standbys for saving time at the table, and this is all style based on your personal style, is that, let's say, Jessica speaks Draconic, but I'm the one who has whatever the argument is that we're trying to make to these kobolds that we're talking to. I'm like, all right, so I say, hello, we want to speak with you, and they're like, they don't understand you. Okay, translate it into Draconic. And I just continue speaking because we assume that Jessica is translating perfectly whatever the hell I'm saying, and is doing it in the same way that I am.
Truly spoken like, but he's never done translation.
Yeah, it's like, we would very much like to trade with you. And she translates, the guy in the ponytail is tasty. Kill him and roast him instead of me.
Maybe that too, right?
So, not that that has ever happened again. So, basically, you can, if you want to add some more depth to the idea that the separation of languages and who knows what language is important, is that you can make your players place a game of telephone. And again, it'll get tired eventually, but it can be a fun little experiment to begin with.
Yeah, so another way to create a sense of there being different languages in the world obviously you can create short phrases in a conlang. Like we have an example from, I think, Dragonlance?
That's one from Dragonlance Solaris Oath Misoth, which is My Honor is My Life. It gets used by the principal knighthood in this setting, and it's thrown around by one of the main characters so often that over the course of the books, the reader's like, oh, I know what that is. That is not only a statement of what this person believes, but it is a direct tie-in for the setting itself. And so if you have something like a slogan or the like, players can really take ownership of that thing. And use it as, you know, a battle cry, or use it as even just this statement as an explanation of, why are you not doing this thing? My honor is my life. Okay, yes, we've heard that argument before, please!
Well, and so another way to give a sense of that is creating slogans in English that sound a little, like, maybe too formal, or just are, like, maybe just not how you would say things, not using common idioms, which gives the sense that this is a translation from another language. Or, you know, you can also just come up with phrases and give people enough information about it that they can sort of take pieces of those and make them into other phrases, which those are the two blog entries I did. There's not a ton of Kalish there, but there's enough that you can probably figure out, like, oh, this is a verb, this is a noun.
So I also like using fantasy languages as a way of defining super specific terms that have no point in the real world. Forthalgen, the sound of dragon wings in flight. We don't really have a good sound for, oh shit, why does that thing have an 80-foot wingspan overhead? But if I want to, and it's almost a little bit onomatopoeic as well, so it gives you a little derivation in that regard, of, oh hey, do I want to put this thing into poetry, or do I just want to express a term really fast? Great, I have it right there. Or you can start coming up with something that's halfway between a common noun and a proper noun, like Gaurbach, a form of goblin pickle. Whether this is a brand name or whether this is just the equivalent of saying hummus. I don't know, but you can come up with these things that start tying these languages into the basis of your setting to define very specific terms that are iconic to you.
So, how do we make languages relevant? How do we make them more than just a d20 roll that you succeed or you fail, or just yet another thing on somebody's character sheet? Go to the next slide. Oh, there we go.
There we go.
So sometimes I do house rules that treat first and second languages differently. John and I almost did a deck for this presentation, a card deck.
Publishing.
I know, like the critical hit and critical fumble deck. The terrible things that can happen if you don't actually know it, if you've only done the first IMSWIT course, and you decide to try and open diplomatic negotiations.
Yeah, it's basically the deck of many linguistic mishaps. So depending upon how much you botched your linguistics check by, you draw that many cards, and you get to choose from those cards. If you really botch it, you only get one draw, and it could be the, like, act of war faux pas. So...
Yeah, it's like, I thought I said he was pretty. It's like, no, you said, may all his teeth fall out. Who knows? Again, using texting and messaging programs to control who knows what about what's being said. If the PCs need to translate a text in an ancient language that is not, you know, spoken anywhere anymore, like, if they're... It's easy to treat ancient Osirian or Syriani the same as we treat Elven, which is probably not... particularly realistic, right? Elven is a language that there's actually a nation where they speak it as their native tongue. And also, it's, you know, a pretty common language that a lot of people know. There are half-elves. There's a whole half-elven diaspora. Should probably feel different if you're doing something with Elven than it does if you're doing something with ancient Syriani. If you're having people translate, consider just doing, like, a cipher, a substitution cipher for them to solve to approximate the work of translation, especially if you have other stuff going on and it's time sensitive, right? Them trying to crack the cipher while, you know, other stuff is happening around them and it's like, make a roll! You know, kind of approximates translating something under stress.
Tied into the first, second, and beyond languages, one of the things that you can do as a player, even, is sort of establish, okay, what are my character's native languages? And then we have, okay, you gained a level over the past week. You took a point in linguistics. Congratulations, you're fluent in Draconic. Okay. I mean, that is how the game mechanics work, but you might want to express that a little bit more than having read through a 16-page correspondence course. So one of the things that worked with great success in a Mummy's Mask game that I was playing in is one of the other players waited until, like, ninth level to take Ancient Osiriani, and had been standing there kind of nodding along unknowingly to everything that we were saying up until then. Then she eventually took Ancient Osiriani, and what she did is she decided that there were certain nouns that she was going to use way more frequently to express, like, oh, hey, I don't understand how the sound structure works. And there were certain nouns that she was going to always mistranslate. So she would occasionally be like, okay, I'll talk to this one. And, be going in for an interrogation, be like, tell us how to sit the sofa! Like, I was like, what? Wait, what? And then she turned back to us and come and be like, I'm asking him where the mask is! No, you're not. The sofa! Where the sofa, damn it! Okay, we're gonna take over from here. But it's a nice little reminder that language learning is a gradual process. So you can have a lot of fun with that, especially if it creates horrifically ironic misfortune.
On the other hand, using an NPC's favorite language might result in bonuses, right? Like, dragons are smart, they usually speak common. But speaking to a dragon in Draconic, like, that might make the dragon like you better if you're speaking it well.
If your accent is good.
You might get eaten. But, you know, so there can be bonuses if a character, just like in the real world, if you are speaking to somebody whose native language is not English, and you speak their language, sometimes speaking to them in their language is something that they appreciate the effort that you've put in. NPCs can behave the same way.
But you shouldn't go up to someone and be like, hola, mi amigo.
Mi llamo, S1.
You want to show that you have put some effort into learning and learning to pronounce it, right? Our coworker, Diego, mentioned to me a while back that, like, a lot of people pronounce his name as Diego, with, like, this long E, and that, you know, he really appreciates when people pronounce it with a short E, because they're pronouncing his name correctly. So, you know, it matters in real life. You make it matter in the game, too. Cultural context for language, right, may have extra significance. If you're, you know, Latin has extra significance in the Catholic Church. You can do similar things in your game where if somebody knows a language that is a language with ritual or historical significance, that understanding that language may give them cultural context that other characters don't understand, or it may, you know, again, get them bonuses because they're speaking Latin in Rome.
And because language is usually a process that's acquired over a considerable amount of time, then language can also serve as a gatekeeper to basically determine, okay, who's part of our greater tribe? Who's part of our organization? So we have the example of language as a form of gatekeeping with shibboleth versus sibboleth pronunciation. Where it's like, if you can pronounce this one consonant that is a difficult consonant, then you probably were raised speaking this language. Welcome aboard. You're part of the gang.
The term shibboleth gets used in English to mean that you know, like, the kind of the customs that are the secret password or whatever that show that you're part of an in-group. Comes from a passage in the Bible where they're trying to determine who is from a particular tribe that they're at war with, and they can't pronounce the letter shin as sh, so they would say sibboleth, so they knew their imposter is trying to sneak in.
And then, as far as other gatekeeping goes, speaking of Diego, he helpfully reminded us that there's a great Star Trek episode in Next Generation, which basically the entire language is based off of allegorical expression. They're still using English, but Darmok, exactly. But it's loaded with proper nouns, and it's like, Chaco, when the walls fell, means failure. But until you know, like, what do you mean the walls fell? Who's Shaka? Oh, where's Shaka? So it's a huge gatekeeping because unless you know all of the stories that tie into that, then you're never going to understand things. And you don't have to do it for an entire language. Right. You could just use it for a couple of those slogans.
So in this episode, just in case you haven't seen it, in Star Trek they have universal translators, right, that translate everything perfectly, but they come across this culture where the translator is translating it perfectly, but they still don't understand what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that you can do. If somebody's taken a language and they're new at it at this level, like maybe when they're hearing this language, there are things in it. There are idioms, there are cliches, there are things, there's slang. And you can translate it for them and have stuff that doesn't make sense in English, and then maybe the next level, they've been speaking it a little bit longer now, they start getting the meanings of this.
And in execution, it's no different from like when you're in your close group of friends and you just reference something that you guys all shared together.
Science
Mountain! Science Mountain! Like, there's a small group of us where it's like, Science Mountain, we know, oh, that experience, that sure does mean that thing.
You got a question?
Do you have any suggestions or recommendations on how to handle in-game cultural non-verbal tics and cues that are unique to the culture?
Like how this in Korean doesn't mean that's good?
Hello, my Brazilian friends. Everything's great.
German, the
worst one in Korean is trying to steal a child's nose and you do a little trick with the thumb and the finger. Yeah.
Okay. The same way that we're talking about handling it with language, you can do with nonverbal. I mean, it's another form of communication, and so, like, you can have things like, you can have a symbol that, or a gesture that, you know, you teach your players about wherever they came from that needs a particular, like, a warning symbol or whatever. You know, you see a vampire, you cross yourself, right? And then have them go somewhere else where it means something completely different, and have convey through NPCs' reactions that it does not mean what they think it means.
Yeah, and because learning the language doesn't necessarily convey any of those like hand gestures, then you can lock that behind like knowledge local, for example. So, I speak perfect English, but if you're like, oh yeah, there was one of them, just one, you have to trust me, then you can have all sorts of fun with that.
Okay, so let's turn the lights on so we can see you better for the Q&A. Mm-hmm. Because the slide just says Q&A. Okay, whoa, all right. We're going to start this way and work that way. So.
Okay, so if you have a language that you're incorporating into it, and this language does not have gendered pronouns, should you use the different pronouns, or should you say they, them, or whatever?
So, this is a real-world issue that comes up. Turkish has the same pronoun for he, she, and it. It's just all. And so I would look at how people translate Turkish. A lot of it's contextual, right? Mm-hmm. I stole that for Kalish because I was... That actually makes it different from real, despite the fact that it's largely a Semitic language. It's something that distinguishes it. Semitic languages have a pronouns gendered, but so are nouns and verbs. So you can't even tell a dog to stop biting you unless you know what gender it is. It's super fun. it's largely up to you. I would probably translate it with they and them, since it's the most commonly used non-gendered pronoun, but, look at different translations. Even, Google translates a lot better than it used to be, so, look at different languages with non-gendered pronouns and see how Google translates it.
And on top of that, because you're probably using all of this, or you're using a fair amount of this language in translation already, because we're basically like, oh, I'm sure I'm speaking Draconic. I'm going to hold my hand up like this every time I'm doing Draconic. But I'm still speaking English. You can simply replace several words in English to represent that difference. Mm-hmm. And so just never use he or she in whatever your translation is.
Okay, everybody who had questions? Okay.
You guys were talking about gatekeeping, and the first thing that came to mind is if someone had, learned to speak English in England back in the beginning of the Elizabethan era, but they learned from a peasant, they wouldn't be ready to use diplomacy with the king or queen.
Yeah, we actually even have that, have an echo in English of class distinctions because the Normans came in and took over England, so most of the nobility was Norman, they were speaking a version of French, and then you had the peasantry that was Saxon, speaking a Germanic language, and so that distinction is still preserved in English in that we have different terms for the meat for a particular animal than we do for the animal itself. So we have pork, but pig. We have beef, but cow. And that's because, and most of the terms for meat come from Romance languages because the nobility that was seeing these animals primarily as dinner was using one term to mean it, and the peasantry who was raising these animals was using it for the animal themselves. So. Language nerdery.
That's my
fun fact. Who else? Okay, start with you.
One fun thing I saw in a game once was you didn't just know a language or not. You had a score of 1 to 3 or 1 to 5 or something. And, 1 was you can ask where the bathroom is, and 5 is where all the in-jokes are. And it would be very easy to break up linguistics that way. Even if you were worried about charging more skill points for it and making it more expensive to take, you could say, every point you put into it gives you 5 fluency points. So you could be fluent in one language or you could be conversant in 2 languages or whatever. But I wanted to ask about things you can't translate from one language to another. Because there was a fascinating thing with the new Star Wars movie. So in English, The Last Jedi is ambiguous. But there are languages it was translated into. And when people started seeing the ads for that, they were like, wait a minute, Jedi in that title is plural. If I call you Ms. Price, that's a politically loaded English term, which may not exist in other languages. So.
Yeah, so
it's good fun because then you can have cultures who are interested in different things and have distinctions in their languages, which you can't.
So, I speak Hebrew not completely fluently, but enough that I can think in it. And
I mean, you killed some kobolds last week, so now you're fluent.
Yeah. I love that. One of the interesting things when you speak a language that's not close to your native language is you learn that there are things you can think about in that language that you can't really. Like, when you try and switch back over, you don't understand the concept even anymore. There's a lot of really rich... Who saw Arrival? Right? Okay, so if you haven't seen Arrival, you need to fix that because it is a minor miracle that the movie even got made. It's amazing. Also read the short story. It's based on the story of your life, Bit Head Chang. He lives here. I met him at a party once.
You're so cool.
I know, right? Well, and I didn't know. He was like, oh, yeah, we're talking. And he's like, yeah, I have a movie based on one of my my short stories coming out. And, like, if you live in the Seattle area, you know, we're north from L.A., you hear that a lot, but usually what that means is, like, some indie movie with a $10,000 budget is... And then, like, the trailers for Arrival start coming out, and I'm like, oh, that was cha-ching! That was that cha-ching! But anyway, Arrival really mines the potential of what is not translatable between languages by asking, like, what if we had to communicate with an alien race that has a language, but that language works completely differently, and, like, it kind of takes the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, the idea that your language controls how you think, and so you can't think about things, really, if you don't have language to describe them. Like, you know, you can have feelings about them or whatever, but you can't really think about them unless there are words.
Like Newspeak.
Yeah.
In 1980.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The limits of your language are the limits of your world, right?
Language. That was a double plus good comment.
But so, Arrival takes that to a really far extent with, like, what would it mean for a human being to start speaking an alien language, you know, with a language generated by creatures that don't have a lot of the same appendages, don't have the same way of seeing reality, don't have the same way of seeing time. Would that change anything? I'm not going to spoil what happens, but you need to see it. Really strong feelings about this.
And when it comes to using that at the table, it depends on who's translating from what. So, if it's somebody who has that term and it's translating into another language, then they might sort of blink and say, "I don't get the distinction. I don't understand what you mean." Like you said, cow. Then you said beef, but the same. And if it's the other way around, you might just never use anything but that made up word.
You might not translate it, right?
Yeah.
So if you're telling people what the translation is, you might still have a make up a nonsense term for this concept that's untranslatable. Mm-hmm. And the same way that you can start to understand it if you're not a native speaker, which is contextual, right? And start to get the sense of what a word means just by context. You can do that with an in-game gibberish term that you've made up, right? If you keep using it in a particular way, it can come to mean stuff to the players. The other thing I've done sometimes is, you know, when I have a concept or whatever, a lot of times like an emotion in a fantasy language that I don't want to give players a specific one-to-one translation for, like, I will find a piece of art and be like, they're feeling this. that word means this.
And, yep.
So. Yes.
In a campaign that just started, we've only had two sessions so far, my group decided we were going to do a sort of a creative writing and design experiment where we together created a setting. And it overall has worked out pretty well. But I forgot about one sort of key detail. And when I sat down for the first session, I was reminded that in this setting, somehow as a group, it was decided that there would be no common. So my question is, how big of a mistake have we made?
face-to-face tabletop, then you're going to run into some trouble. But on the other hand, if you're doing face-to-face tabletop, you have possibly the second best medium for that, because you have pantomime. Like, if you're doing virtual tabletop, but in a live setting, that would probably be the hardest one. Because you can't show what you're doing, you can't take the time to translate and do all that stuff like you would in a play-by-post. But it can still be pretty interesting, especially as you start to create your own group pigeon. Of like, all right, every time I grab a banana and wave it like this, it means we're going to flank the target, okay? Banana tactics.
Do you know, I'm drawing a blank, but there's actually a language learning technique that starts out with, like, having an apple, and, like, the things you do with the apple help people. You don't tell them this word means this. You just start speaking to them in the language and, you know, hand the apple to them, take the apple from them, hide the apple, and it's supposed to mimic the way that we learn as kids. So it's... there's a name for that technique, and I'm drawing a total blank. It's really good at getting people able to...
Immersion.
I
know
that
it's, for teaching.
Yeah, like, it's different from that. It's got a very specific set of gestures and, like, actions that go with it. But what they've discovered is, like, you don't actually need that many words in common to do basic communication. It's, like, 300 words, and you can communicate fairly fluently with somebody. And so if you start out like that with your group, where nobody speaks the same language, where you figure out, like, okay, I'm going to do this gesture to indicate that I want this, you actually can end up creating that group pigeon really fast.
And on top of that, what you end up doing is you end up creating your own allegorical statements that share within your real-life group that you can use from then on.
Science Mountain.
Science Mountain. Banana tactics.
You and your hand wrists?
Fish biscuit. You brought up a really great point. In fact, if I'm not mixing up my titles, My Fair Lady did exactly what you're talking about, Lydia, where she came from the poor section, and they talked to gutter talk, so to speak, and she was being trained up in a great movie, if you like.
The rain in Spain falls mostly on the plain.
Mainly.
Well, I dare.
How dare you, sir?
I'm not part of this tribe.
One of the things that I was interested about is related languages, that kind of thing. But I come from a family of linguists. I'm the runt of the litter, unfortunately. But I mean, I have brothers who wrote their doctorates in foreign languages and things like they're like crazy people. But one of my brothers said, he wrote the textbooks for Italian adults to learn Italian or learn English. And I said, when did you know that you actually, like, knew Italian? He said, when I started dreaming in it.
Yeah.
You know, that was when he...
It's actually a line in Arrival.
Yeah. Oh, is it?
Yeah. It's a linguist thing. Yeah.
But,
when you start dreaming in a language, you're probably...
The relationship to languages, I mean, like, romance languages, clearly in the real world, or, like, Aklo and Draconic would have related, because Aklo is from Serpent and...
Yep.
You know, that kind of thing. Have you guys ever played with that? Like, almost like having a half of a rank in it or something?
I remember one of the first RPGs I ever looked at was Hero System, and I remember that they had an entire page that had different bubbles around different language groups, and it was basically, hey, do you know one of these things? All right, learning a language within this costs 1 point, learning outside of that is 2 points, learning outside of that even is 3 points.
Yeah.
So you can do that. As far as what Paizo has done to establish what is true about the relationships between different languages, largely we haven't. There are a couple of exceptions. For example, we've said that we've talked about some of the origins of Tekrutanin, Shadow Tongue, and Skald, if I recall correctly, as well as even a little bit about Common as Aslanti roots. So you could make some jumps with that. And if you wanted to, for example, house rule the ease of learning some of those languages, you could say, all right, do you already have one of the things in this language group? If you put a point of linguistics into learning this thing, bam, you have it. No problem. Even if it's an overnight, you know, where we have to sort of blur the line chronologically. But if you want to jump language groups, then maybe every point of linguistics you put in is half the language. And so you might have only casual fluency with it. Until you put in another rank, at which point, okay, great, now I've got the hang of this thing because this language didn't have nouns before and I was not used to that.
I also do things like, if a character speaks a Gurundi language and somebody's speaking Osiriani, it's like, well, you don't understand what he's saying, but you catch this word that you recognize in that word. So if somebody has a language that you want to say is related to another language, and again, we have not done the language family tree, so because...
continuity.
So, you can decide what languages in the world are related, right? And so you can give people bonuses, essentially, where they get some sense from hearing it.
That was, and then, and this is a weird one, but it's actually true because I had to study it for a book we're writing. People can understand their cats.
Yes!
But very quickly, they can actually, their cats and them can communicate.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's all demands. But,
yes.
Because they're cats.
Correct.
But,
briefly, if you have a cat, you have a private language.
Yeah,
only you
but
your
that's
cat speak.
Yeah, but that's, it's interesting, is people can't, like, pick up another cat and automatically understand.
Right.
It's not a language from that perspective.
Right,
it's
agreed upon.
It's a private language that you use. Mm-hmm. Have you ever done anything with that where you've had to deal with?
Yeah.
My cats have very large vocabularies because I talk to them a lot.
Yeah, we do. The familiar.
Yep.
The familiar at fifth level gains the ability to communicate with its master and only its master using a private language. So whether you've chosen a cat or not, you're going to have that capacity.
There's also the spell for that.
Yes.
And party members.
Yeah, which extends it to everybody. Yes.
So, one of the things that I've seen represented in real life that isn't necessarily represented in any of the content by Paizo very well, or by any other gaming company, is the concept of, I mean, you've touched on gestural additives to language, but never fully gestural languages. We've got Hugin and Featherspeak, and Featherspeak is sort of an alteration of the Hugin in tone and in direct meaning. But what has never been touched on is fully gestural language. And something that I've noticed about the world is every culture has a fully gestural language because there are altered human beings who cannot hear, cannot see, et cetera, et cetera. We've also got tactile languages that are less well taught. So I wondered if that was something that we might be able to see in future development.
I think we have one fully gestural language and it's evil.
For that, so deaf people are evil.
What makes a language?
So that's why we need to fix it.
So two things on this front. First off, be sure to pick up the Starfinder Core rulebook when it comes out. Second off, one of the weird things about us putting in these languages partway through is that we don't have them from the beginning. So we have 5-6 bestiaries full of creatures, none of which have sign language, and none of which can spontaneously learn sign language. So if, and this is what I run into with Pathfinder Society organized plays, people are asking, can we have a sign language? And it's sort of a, well, I want to be inclusive in that front. But the other issue is that suddenly everybody has a sign language that nothing else in the system can ever understand, so all they have is a secret language that is silent. So suddenly it's a tactical boon. Right. So that's what makes me uneasy on that front. So it's something that from the ground up is fantastic to incorporate, but that can be difficult to introduce mid-season, mid-series, mid-game. I've probably got time for one more.
Yep. Right.
So in my Hell's Rebels campaign, the GM offered our group Danishes, and I asked them where in Galarian Danishes come from. So how do you get Earth out of your fantasy languages?
So I'm coming up with new names for them.
All right.
Apple tart.
Fair, Taldans. Yummy, yummy Taldans.
Quick.
Can you recommend a program for phoneme and word inventory for building?
There are, if you go to Zompist.com, or wait, is it Zompist? There's a wiki that has all kinds of conlang tools. Just Google like conlang tools, and like some of them are lexicon generators. Some of them are actually. I mean, the problem with lexicon generators is that there's not a ton out there that is intelligent, right? So they will just put together sounds and tell you it means this. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the word you get for horse is going to be related to the word for saddle. Right. So you may have to do some tweaking. But if you just want to generate something that sounds like your language.
Yes.
Awesome. Well,
and, then, we're happy to talk about languages at any time you find us around.
Yeah, you can find us in the bar.
Pretty much.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to No Direction Podcast.com.